Welcome to the Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Marius Ruiz. Marius, how are you?
How are you, Nick?
Pretty good, thank you. And Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I am all right, thanks, Nick. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's a pretty good place to be on a Tuesday, I suppose. Once again, hello to our new Cliff Central listeners. We hope you are enjoying the show so far. Let's dive right into it with our first topic, which is we talked a little bit about this, these sort of internal ANC developments yesterday with Sarah and Terence, but I thought we could go a little bit more into some specifics here, which is that Cyril Ramaphosa has allegedly he spoke to members of the National Executive Committee of the ANC, which is its highest decision-making body outside of Congress's, and he wanted a resolution adopted by the NEC, which said that family members of senior ANC members, NEC members, should not be able to do business with the state. It should be party policy that this is the case. He received a lot of pushback from various members of the committee, allegedly Ace Magashula, ANC's general secretary, attacked him. Others pushed back too and said, well, what about his own son, Cyril's son, that is, who allegedly has secured a 6 million rand contract with the government of Gauteng to provide ventilation for taxis. And ultimately, it appears that there was no decision taken at the NEC meeting on this issue, and they decided to push the agenda forward to another meeting in which they would take a firmer decision. So it looks like his great attempt to make any sort of change on corruption may have failed here, which led the opposition DA MP Dean McPherson to say on Twitter, quote, Ramaphosa is finished, even in the face of national outrage. He can't lead and he won't lead. It's pathetic. Herman, is Ramaphosa actually finished, or is he overblowing the political significance of this?
I think it's somewhere in between the two. I don't think Ramaphosa is finished yet. There's still some ways to go before the complete collapse of the Ramaphosa presidency takes hold. But I must say, I'm starting to think that it doesn't really matter. If there's one thing that has become clear over the lockdown, it is the extent to which the people were within a nanometer of turning on the ANC. And this shouldn't come as a surprise. I mean, if you look at socioeconomic trends and if you look at electoral trends over the last 26 years, you really see the direct correlation between material circumstances of the individual voter and the ANC's support. And it is fascinating that I think the first mistake people make is to think that the ANC is divided in two factions, the reformers and the corrupt cadres. But that's not quite true. The corrupt cadre is definitely a bunch of scallywags and the Ace Magashules of the world. But to look at the Ramaphosa camp and, you know, Tito Mboweni and Pravin Gordhan and see them as reformers, I think is a fundamental mistake. But the one thing that I do think that kind of differentiation hits on that is true is that the Ramaphosa camp has something of a connection to reality. I think the awareness of if the ANC does not take aggressive visual steps against corruption now, then it just hastens the complete collapse of trust in the ANC, even amongst, you know, what might have been traditionally their voter base. And remember, this is the party that came to a 50-50 split on continuing the Zuma years versus not continuing the Zuma years. So this NEC meeting really is a reflection of that same old tension. This is the exact same battle as Nasrec 2017. It's a 50-50 split. It is fought to a neutral bloody draw. But here you have a situation where while Ramaphosa is the best hope for the ANC, and Ramaphosa was clearly the best hope for the ANC in 2017, he squeaked into the presidency. Ramaphosa today remains the best hope for the ANC, but he cannot even get the ANC to come out strongly against corruption. So I think this might be the end of the Ramaphosa presidency. I don't believe it is. What I do think it is very indicative of is the unsavability of the ANC fundamentally. If even now the ANC cannot bring itself to say, you know, corruption bad, then it really has lost the public. And I think they lost the public some time ago, but the anger that you see from people who traditionally would have been ANC supporters, and even if you listen to business, you know, in whispered conversations in behind closed doors, you see some of Ramaphosa's final Ramaphoriac allies giving up on this, just thinking that if now, even if now, they cannot, Ramaphosa cannot make any headway, then it's not necessarily whether the Ramaphosa presidency is savable. It's that the ANC as a political movement isn't.
One of the interesting things about the entire internal ANC conflict that I've seen is that Ramaphosa continues to be far more popular with the South African population. And in fact, in the early stages of lockdown, his popularity went up to sort of 60s, 70s. He has the backing of a large portion of big business South Africa, corporate South Africa. He's got a numerous allies in the media, although they seem to be dwindling now. And yet he never leveraged this to make himself more powerful within the ANC. He always stuck into the internal dynamics of the party. He didn't go outside the party to sort of seek help. He didn't bash the party for supporting others outside it. Maurice, why do you think maybe he did this?
I don't know. It's hard to say. We always get told that Cyril Ramaphosa is a great consensus builder. And that's why he'd been such a great negotiator during the transition in the early 1990s. So perhaps that's part of it, where he's a guy who wants to get consensus. And there's quite a lot of disparate groups in the ANC, different factions that he's got to keep happy. And maybe that's why he's kind of paralyzed. But, I mean, the guy is, in theory, the most powerful. He's definitely the most powerful man in the ANC. Definitely the most powerful man in the country. You'd think he'd be able to, implement his agenda. But I think also what this NEC meeting also shows that the ANC is only paying lip service to fighting corruption. It was quite interesting last week to see on social media and comments from senior ANC leaders was coming out hard against corruption. Now it's a terrible thing. I mean, this is what we all know, but it's actually quite refreshing to see senior ANC people saying it. And we saw people like Dave Masondo getting suspended and so on. Andile Lungisa down in Nelson Mandela Bay just stepped down from the mayoral committee there, apparently on the request of Ace Magashule. But then we see what's happening in the NEC, where people they oppose this policy to not allow people's family members to do business with the government, or whatever the case is. It just shows, I mean, it's just lip service, and the ANC's got to do a lot more to show that it's serious about fighting corruption.
Herman, some final thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think two things that Marius definitely touches on. I think the leadership failings of Ramaphosa. I think the best book on Ramaphosa that I've read was Ralph Mateka's Ramaphosa's Turn, or Cyril's Turn. I can't exactly remember. I think it's Ramaphosa's Turn. Can Cyril Save South Africa? And I think it's quite a good book. I think Mateka is quite fair in his analysis of Ramaphosa as a leader. But even in Mateka's very charitable, and I think there's a spectrum of fair. He's on the charitable end of the fairness spectrum, but I think he's still fair in his analysis of Mateka. But even within Mateka's own relatively sympathetic portrayal of Ramaphosa. You do get someone whose weakness in leadership is dithering because of this pursuit of building consensus. And that is something that dates back to Ramaphosa's union days, where you needed to build consensus. It wasn't decision-making that demanded leadership. It was unity that demanded leadership. And South Africa isn't in a situation where consensus can get us out of the trouble, and I think everyone can see that. So I think what made him a useful leader of a movement or several movements that have a clear objective is that building of a common pursuit, and you know, the rhetoric of having being everyone's friend. But I think the fact that we are not in a situation where we need a unity leader, we need a decisive leader, this is where he pales in comparison to Mandela, who was absolutely decisive and could stamp his authority on the party. And a last very interesting point on something you said, Nick, is our sentiment tracking on social media picked up something very interesting that happened about a month ago, you know, mid-lockdown, is there's a very clear distinction in how people react to government and ANC. And if you and if Ramaphosa and ANC are mentioned in a social media post or in an article, then Ramaphosa still gets a positive sentiment while the ANC doesn't. But when Ramaphosa and government are mentioned, both positive sentiments go up. So people have this kind of cognitive dissonance where Ramaphosa, when associated with the government, still retains this idea. But that was before the absolute disaster of this last week, with the IMF coming in, the launch to get corruption going, and then the NEC just clapping Cyril Ramaphosa in the face and not even allowing him to say the ANC is against corruption.
Maurice, you have some final thoughts here?
Yeah, just our senior colleague, Frans Corneus, pointed out, and I think he's right, he said that if Cyril Ramaphosa had taken over after Nelson Mandela, he would have probably been a pretty good president, just kept things chugging along. We need somebody with a bit more testicular fortitude, as Harriman says, somebody who's not a consensus builder, but who's a bit more decisive. So maybe a Thabo Mbeki actually would have been kind of the guy would need to clean up Jacob Zuma's mess. But I don't think Cyril Ramaphosa is the guy. Maybe he'll still surprise us, but I mean, he's been in charge for 2.5 years, and you know, we haven't seen anything to really, you know, make us think that he's got what it takes to turn the good ship South Africa around after Jacob Zuma nearly drove us into an iceberg.
A very, very brief thing that I just want to say on this is we must realize that the ANC's leadership bench is exhausted. If you think 10 years ago, who were the bigwigs in the ANC? Today, who are the bigwigs in the ANC? It's the same generation, the same people. So I think the ANC, when Mbeki took over from Mandela, they were quite a lot of leaders who could have stepped up. You can look at Kgalema Motlanthe, even Lekota, Zuma, Mbeki, Ramaphosa, Dlamini Zuma. There was a bench. There was a deep bench. And the ANC doesn't have a deep bench anymore. This generation has been it for a decade, and it is it. They don't have natural successors.
Of course, you are forgetting the rebranded ANC Youth League, which we usually call the EFF, which does have a couple of, shall we say, divisive personalities in it, who perhaps could at least fill some of that bench up with some weight, as I'm sure will probably happen at some point. We will see more EFF in the ANC as time goes by. But that's it for today. Let's go on to our next topic, and this is, of course, lockdown related. SA Wine Farmers, a group which includes, it's made up of several farmers, but one of the groups involved is called the Agri Initiative. They requested records from government as to why they instituted the alcohol ban. And they claim that the records they received show that most of the discussion and evidence presented to justify the ban was relating to the long-term harm of alcohol and is not related to the pandemic. The organization itself has is going to take Lamini Zuma and the government to court to have the regulations banning alcohol declared invalid and unconstitutional. Specifically, however, only in the case where it relates to the transportation and selling of wine. And they've made several claims that wine is not as dangerous as other alcohols in terms of the negative effects for the lockdown. Here's what they say. She did not at all deem it relevant to consider consumer patterns in relation to wine. She also did not obtain evidence regarding the contribution of any of the abuse of wine to trauma cases. And they went on to make the claim that wine was different to, say, for example, beer or hard liquor. Homan, do you think there's any chance that they will be successful in their court application?
I do. I do actually think so, for the fundamental reason that backed up by the, I think it was Judge Davis's decision in the De Beer case, that highlighted the fact that in terms of the Disaster Management Act, the regulations the appropriate minister can promulgate into force really needs to be very narrowly and very clearly connected to the objective of the disaster. That is really the hinge of why I think they will be successful, because I think the Pretoria High Court Judge Davis was right in finding that. I think the Act is quite clear in that regard. And the absurdity, the mere fact that they could, that the link, the causal link between the minister's incredibly damaging economic or socioeconomic policy decision is so weak to actually, you know, anything related with COVID-19 and the country's ability to cope with it. It is so astounding, so out here, that if they are not legally successful, if they are not legally successful and the judiciary does not give them, the benefit of the doubt and the victory in this argument, then pack up, then the judiciary of this country really isn't worth much.
Marius, let's talk a little bit more broadly about the alcohol ban at all. We've been over it before, but I think it's worth reiterating some of those points. Has it been effective, do you think, in terms of its stated goal? I mean, there's some who say that there are some arguments in the short term for banning it. Do you think that the government's stated reasons of trying to reduce trauma cases in the hospitals is the real reason behind the ban? And do you think it'll ever really, how long do you think it's going to remain before it's lifted again?
I think there is a puritanical streak in the ANC. I think Panyaza Lesufi is a good example. He's always tweeting about I can't see anymore because he blocked me. But before he blocked me, he used to tweet hashtag #alcohol-free SA and so on. And I think Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma is probably also from that kind of school of thought. So I think the part of this alcohol ban is part of a puritanical effort on part of the ANC. But South Africa isn't the only country that did ban alcohol because of COVID. I know Sri Lanka did for a while, India did, a couple of other countries. But I think I stand under correction, but I think we're the only one who banned it twice and who's also kept the ban in place for so long. And also, around this date around COVID, I've read things where it says trauma cases have gone down significantly because of the alcohol ban, and it's a great idea, blah, blah, blah. And then other people who come from a different point of view, also doctors, say the alcohol ban had nothing, or the alcohol ban has had no impact on trauma beds, and you don't use trauma beds to treat COVID patients anyway, so it wouldn't have made a difference. So who knows what the true story is? I mean, just looking at it from somebody who's not all that well informed on it, I would be surprised if the alcohol ban didn't have some impact on trauma beds. I mean, we know that South Africans do have quite an unhealthy relationship with alcohol. But at the same time, we all liberals here, or at least the three people on this podcast at the moment, and liberals generally support the rights of individuals to make choices about how they want to live their lives. So I don't think, you know, banning alcohol is the answer. And I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there is some in the ANC who'd want to ban it permanently. But I think that would be very hard to do. And I think the resulting economic distraction, if alcohol had to be banned unilaterally, like I think some would like to do. I don't know if the economic distraction and the number of jobs and downstream industries from alcohol, you know, from SAB and people who make beer, etc., would be worth it, actually. And also the taxes will lose as well.
Of course. Toman, you had something to add?
Yeah, I think the first thing that we should, a few things that we should acknowledge. Firstly, that I think the, what was it, 93% of smokers continued smoking during lockdown. So that's the first thing, is bans don't work. They just don't. The second thing that we must take into account is that the Western Cape, a week ago there was a Business Day article saying Western Cape peaks with room to spare. And I think, that does go some way to make the case that, you know, if you have room to spare within your hospital capacity, then there were other ways to ensure that you your trauma units aren't overwhelmed by alcohol-related incidents. But then the overarching point that I actually want to make is that this is it's a point that Henry Hazlitt makes. This is bad economics 101. It is short-termism of the worst kind. It is ignoring the medium and long-term consequences for a short-term, possible, a questionable short-term gain. What will happen if this ban continues much longer? I think already the economic damage inflicted on this sector is profound. The economic damage that sector will, in terms of knock-on effects to the communities that will be dependent on, or that were dependent or still hope to be dependent on the sector and its financial viability, that will have a knock-on effect into poverty. Poverty is one of the upward drivers for the cost of public health care. So you might have, in the best case scenario, have freed up some trauma space, but you have saddled the healthcare system of this country for the next 10 years with an increased poverty burden, a decreased revenue stream, and somehow you think that's a win. That is typical bad economics that we should call out. It is the idiocy of short-term decision-making and not really looking at the implications and the opportunity costs of the awesome power that government can wield over its citizens.
And of course, the other thing to consider is that alcohol during bans is provided by the black market. In this case, organized crime usually gets involved. And the thing about once organized crime is involved in a market is, even if you then remove, let's say in this case, the alcohol, firstly, it won't be gone completely because the black market doesn't pay taxes and so it can usually undercut legit players. And secondly, once these networks are set up, these supply networks are set up by organized crime to sell alcohol to people, they're going to use that money to fund expansion to other areas. And I'm sure the same thing is, of course, happening with the cigarette ban. And so I think the long-term crime consequences that will result from this will also be significant. But let's move on to our last topic for today, which is that, Maurice, you've seen some interesting discussion online, and we were having a talk earlier before the show about, we often talk in South Africa about the lost decade under Zuma, where economic growth was slow and sluggish, GDP per capita fell in the later years of the Zuma presidency, and we just really lost a lot of progress that we had made during the Thabo Mbeki years. You saw a discussion about whether South Africa might be headed for a second lost decade.
Well, what I saw on Twitter, I follow a guy called Noah Smith. He's an opinion writer for Bloomberg. And if anybody's interested in economics and so on, I don't always agree with the guy, but he tweets some interesting stuff. You should give him a follow. But anyway, so he just tweeted something yesterday saying, what three developing countries are you the most optimistic about for the 2020s? And it's been quite a long thread. I've just gone through it. And South Africa is not on anybody. I haven't seen South Africa mentioned once, except for one or two people saying it will never be South Africa. And the general list seems to be places like Vietnam, Rwanda, Ghana, Bangladesh, Ethiopia, India, Malaysia, even though some people say it's actually a developed country now, you can't really count it. So it's quite interesting. And I think it just shows that South Africa, as you say, we had a lost decade in the 2010s. And on our current policy trend, I think we're going to have a lost decade in the 2020s too. We've seen that the government is not all that interested in proper reforms. I mean, there's a solitary reformer in the entire cabinet, and that's Tito Mboweni, who seems to be fighting a losing battle. And as we also said earlier, it's often when you kind of crowdsource ideas from a crowd, it's actually, or from a group of people, it actually gives you a better view of what is actually going to happen. Like we said, or like you told me, which I think is quite interesting. If you ask people who they think is going to win an election, they even if they don't think even it's different from the person they support, a crowd is often generally right. And I think, yeah, if we see that so few people are saying South Africa is going to be a country to watch in the 2020s, I think that's probably also right. And I mean, we as I say, we all know why South Africa is not a place that, is likely to shoot the lights out when it comes to developments in the next decade. So just something I thought it was interesting. And I think, it confirms what most of us think about the current trajectory, economic and policy trajectory of South Africa.
So, Herman, my question to you is, if we're competing on that list against countries like Rwanda, which has an incredibly authoritarian regime, or Ghana, who has way less infrastructure than us, why in the world would people out there be thinking that those countries have a much better shot at making it than we do?
I think part of the answer would be to look at the hand that was dealt and the potential that was available and then squandered. I do think that South Africa came very, very close to embarking on a prosperous, freedom-based, multiracial democracy. And I think that chance was squandered. And I think part of the negativity around South Africa is it's the disappointment factor that, you had so much going for you. Of course, you had a lot that counted against you, but South Africa really had a lot going for it. And I think it still does. It's just tragic that there doesn't seem to be any way that to convince people realistically that South Africa can change. Now, I do believe South Africa can change, and that's why we do what we do at the Institute. But part of the problem as to why Ghana is ranked above us is, we had a very good opportunity and we blew it. And people who blow such opportunities really, really deserve a second chance.
Well, look, that's the thing. There's always that opportunity for places to change and do the right thing. I always say, if you took somebody from the 1980s to 2010 in South Africa and said, this is South Africa, whatever, 15 years after the end of apartheid, the person wouldn't believe you because of the developments, the relations between the different races, or even a place like Botswana, which when it became independent in 1966, had something like 20 kilometers of paved road. But the Botswana government made the right choices, and we've seen how Botswana is one of the most successful, at least Southern African countries in the world. So it's all about making the right choices. And I never think that something is always a lost cause. Like Caravan says, this is why we do the job that we do. But I think it's, we need to make the right choices soon. Otherwise, it's going to be much harder to turn South Africa around. I think it's already going to be difficult to do it. But if we have another 10 years of, policies that retard growth, in by 2030, we're going to be in a lot of trouble, I think.
So the one thing I've the way I've kind of organized this in my mind is, when you look at a country like Ethiopia, right, which has had one of the fastest growing economies in the world over the last couple of years, it's difficult when you actually look at like photographs of the country to say this country is definitely going to pull ahead of South Africa, because you can just see how much further behind in so many ways it is. But I think what a lot of people in the world have recognized is that a lot of countries out there, especially in Africa, have liberated themselves from some of the failed ideologies that have kept those countries captive for so long. So, of course, Ethiopia was ruled by a authoritarian Marxist military junta called the Dirge. Anyway, forgive my pronunciation. And they created an entirely state-based economy. And now Ethiopia is beginning to move, despite all of its many problems, towards massive privatization. It's liberated itself from the failed ideas of the past, and it's seeing enormous amounts of growth because of that. Herman?
I think you absolutely put your finger on it. In France's latest book, the first chapter really sets out the decision that South Africans must make over the next decade. Do we choose? We are between chosen glory and chosen trauma as a people. Now, this is a social psychological idea that I think has some merit, where a people, a country, a nation, a community can either define itself by the challenges it had faced and overcome, or it can define itself by the challenges it had faced and succumbed to. And that's I think, the heart of the matter here is, will South Africa choose to transform its trauma into a perpetual victimhood, or will we as the Institute convince people to choose better, like the Ethiopians did? So that really is it. That is the heart of the matter. Will we look around us and see challenges that we overcame and more challenges to overcome, or will we see failure and trauma and victimhood? And on a technical, not technical, but on a more, you know, abstract economic point, the thing that we need to make sure survives in South Africa is purchasing power, because Africa has massive demand, and this is one of the failures of demand-side economic approaches. There's massive demand in South Africa for all kinds of products and services. There just isn't the purchasing power to get it. The trick South Africa now needs to get right, and there are very good ways to get it right, is how to harness the purchasing power that we already have, expand it, and ensure that becomes the engine for addressing the massive demands that socioeconomic destitution really saddle us with.
Thank you very much, Herman. Thank you very much, Marius. We're going to call it to a close there. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We will see you tomorrow for our next edition of The Daily Friend. If you would like to become a friend of the Institute of Race Relations and support the work, the research, the analysis that you just heard, that we do here, the alternative voice we provide in the media, please go to our website, irr.org.za, click the Join Us button, give us your details, and sign up to become a friend of the Institute. Friends give small monthly donations to help support the work we do and allow us to function as an independent voice free from big donors. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.